Good afternoon. I'm Anne Applebaum. I run the Transitions Forum at the Legatum Institute. It's a program that looks at comparative political and economic change. One of the things we're really interested in is the reform of security services and police forces in former dictatorships and in other places. And sort of with that hat on, I'm really, really delighted to welcome here today both Gary Hargan and Kevin Bales. Gary is the founder and CEO of the International Justice Mission. He's a former prosecutor at the U.S. Department of Justice. He was the director of the UN Genocide Investigation in Rwanda. He has won an anti-trafficking award from the State Department. He's an extremely distinguished writer and speaker on a wide range of subjects. But here today, he's going to speak about his new book, which is called The Locust Effect, Why the End of Poverty Requires the End of Violence. It's a spectacularly good book. It's some of the reporting is deeply shocking, and it's very worth reading. And it will actually be available downstairs, I'm told, after this. And you're all welcome to take a copy. He's going to speak this morning for about 20 minutes, and then we will do a brief discussion. There will be a response from the equally distinguished Kevin Bales, who's co-founder of the anti-slavery organization Free the Slaves, a very distinguished professor at Hull University who's been writing and speaking about the phenomenon of modern slavery for several decades. His best-known book is called Disposable People, but he's written many, many others. Anyway, I'm really delighted to have both of them here. It's a great honor, and we will begin with Gary.
Thank you very much. Thanks. Well, good afternoon. It is a great honor to get to be here at the Legatum Institute, and I want to thank the whole team here for pulling the event together. And it's likewise an honor to have Anne Applebaum here pulling this afternoon's discussion together. I'm a longtime fan of her columns in the Washington Post. And just grateful, Anne, that you'd be part of this. And Kevin Bales, of course, is just an absolute hero in the global movement to address modern-day slavery. Most of us would be aware of modern-day slavery because of the work of Kevin Bales and his team at Free the Slaves. And so that Kevin would be here responding to the book is marvelous. So thanks, Kevin. We are here today to introduce our book, The Locust Effect, Why the End of Poverty Requires the End of Violence. And we do want to talk about an epidemic of violence taking place against the poor in the developing world. But I want to begin with a story closer to my own home in the United States. It's actually a story of a young woman who was at home in her own house. It was a dark weekend night. She was by herself when suddenly she began to hear this man tearing through the window of her house to attack her. This was particularly terrorizing for her because the man who was coming through the window had actually assaulted her 2 weeks before and put her in the hospital. So now he's tearing through the house again. She's all by herself. She's in a panic, and she does what anyone in the United States does, which is pick up the phone and call 911. I think here in the UK you maybe have 999 as a way to instantly notify law enforcement to be able to have them come and defend you, to bring the law to bear on your behalf. But what happened in her particular case is unbelievably tragic, because what proceeds to happen is a 10-minute conversation with the 911 operator in which this operator has to explain that due to budget cuts in her rural county, there is no law enforcement available on the weekends. So just listen in for a moment to this conversation.
I don't have anybody to send out there. Obviously if he comes inside the residence and assaults you, can you ask him to go away, or do you know if he's intoxicated or anything?
I've already asked him. I've already told him I was telling you he's looking before, but he's down the door assaulted me.
Is there any way you can safely leave the residence?
No, I can't. Because he's locked me pretty much right on the way out.
Well, the only thing I can do is give me some
I don't have anybody to send. Tragically, what happens when there's no one that can go to defend you? That man did break in, strangled her, choked her, raped her. And the reason I start with this is a way to bring to us the reality that confronts billions of the world's poorest people in the way that they have no access to law enforcement that will actually protect them from violence. In fact, the UN did a global study and found that there are 4 billion people who live outside the protection of law, period. In fact, it said specifically that most poor people in the world live outside the protection of law. That basic criminal justice systems are so broken in the developing world that there is no one to come to defend you from this kind of violence. What does that look like in a specific country, that there would be no law enforcement that would defend you from violence? In Bolivia, it looks like this. If you sexually assault a child, you have a greater chance of slipping in the shower and dying than you do of ever being convicted for that crime. Likewise, in India, if you enslave someone, you're at greater risk of being struck by lightning than you are of ever being convicted and sent to prison for that crime. This total breakdown of basic law enforcement in the developing world has unleashed an epidemic now of everyday violence. And I say everyday violence because it's not the violence that tends to make the headlines, sort of the catastrophic spasms of violence, conflicts, wars, mass atrocities. I know something about those events because I was the director of the UN's genocide investigation in Rwanda in 1994 and was given this list of 100 different mass graves and massacre sites across Rwanda where just hundreds of thousands of corpses were just strewn out in the cathedrals and the schools and the stadiums when violence was unleashed. And as we were sorting through these thousands of people butchered by their neighbors and sort of trying to put together the picture of what is it like when those machetes are coming towards you, the thing I remember so vividly was the idea that in that moment of great terror, these poor, very impoverished Rwandans, the average Rwandan was living off about 65 cents a day. And in that moment of terror, when the machete is making its way towards you and towards your family, they were not crying out for food. They were not crying out for doctors or for teachers or for a microloan. They were crying out for someone to restrain the hand of that machete. And just the way that exposed to me the way the problem of violence is different than these other problems. And that if we don't address the problem of predatory violence, it decimates the other things that we are seeking to do on behalf of the poor. The other aspect of this violence that we're trying to emphasize is not only the way that it's the everyday violence, but also that it's hidden. When we think of global poverty, if we were to close our eyes and sort of just associate pictures with global poverty in our mind's eye, we would come up with pictures of the shacks, of probably the children who are malnourished, pictures of dirty water and the sort of lack of health care. But one of the things that should come immediately to our mind when we think of poverty in the developing world is a chronic vulnerability to violence. But violence is different in the sense that it keeps itself hidden because there's a human being who's committing the violence, who actually is trying hard to hide it, but also because the victims of the abuse, because of fear and shame, are also many times also trying to keep the violence below the surface. So there is this vast epidemic of everyday violence, but it is frequently out of our view, and we have to go deeper to find it. So in The Locus Effect, this is what we try to do. We try to take readers into that subterranean world of everyday violence. And there's 4 categories of violence that really most pervasively impact the poor. And the first is gender violence. Of course, this is sexual violence and domestic abuse against women and girls. In fact, the World Health Organization has found that gender violence accounts for more death and disability than malaria, cancer, car accidents, and war combined. And overwhelmingly, the vast majority of the victims of this violence are those who are poorest. The book tries to give you a picture of this, not only by giving you the data that's now emerging, but also taking you alongside some of the victims of this abuse In the opening story, we introduce a woman that I met in Peru named Lucilla, a very typical mom living in the Andean Mountains in a small town. And her 8-year-old daughter is brutally raped and murdered and then just dumped out on the street one day. And you follow Lucilla in what it looks like for her to try to get justice for her daughter. And you begin to see the utter brokenness of a criminal justice system in her community that is incapable of actually bringing her justice or protecting women and girls in her town, which you would never draw any attention to her town, except for the fact that when we were visiting, it was producing a rate of sexual assault against women and girls that was higher than the news reports coming out of the worst war zones of the Congo. But again, because it's just everyday violence, it remains below the surface. The second massive category of violence against the poor is slavery. It simply is true that thanks to Kevin's work and the production now of the Global Slavery Index, we now know there are approximately 30 million people held in slavery in the world today. These are people who are physically held in poverty through the violence of slavery. That's more people in slavery than at any other time in human history. Thankfully, a smaller portion of human beings are in slavery than ever in human history. A smaller proportion of the world's economy is produced by slavery. But just because there's so many more people on the earth now, there are, in absolute numbers, more slavery now than at any other time in history. So this is another vast source of violence against the poor. But again, it remains below the surface. The Locust Effect book takes you actually on a journey to the city of Bangalore in India, the high-tech capital of India that in many ways is representative of the tremendous economic progress in India. But when I arrived in Bangalore, it only took an Indian lawyer about 20 minutes to drive me to the beltway surrounding the city to go meet Mariamma and to see the brick factory where she and dozens of others were held in slavery, working 7 days a week, 12 to 14 hours a day, making and carrying bricks. In fact, they were held there by such terror that if anybody would run away from that brick factory, they'd be chased down, dragged back, and beaten in front of the others. This is in the gleaming high-tech capital that convinced Thomas Friedman that now the world was becoming flat. But if you look beneath that surface, you're going to find millions of people held in slavery. In fact, in Mariamma's case, when two slaves were able to run away to try to attend to their sick children, the owner of that factory went to the village, kidnapped several other relatives and people in the community, and tortured them over several days. And he just very publicly announced that until my slaves come back, I'm going to continue to torture these villagers. Again, no idea in his mind that he ran any risk at all that law enforcement would bring him to account. The third source of violence against the poor in the developing world is police abuse. It turns out that in the developing world, you don't run to the police for protection, you run from the police for protection. In fact, the World Bank did a global study that found that in the developing world, police and criminal justice systems make poor people less secure and poorer. That's like we find out that the hospitals in the developing world make everyone sicker, or the schools in the developing world actually keep everybody from reading. The criminal justice systems have turned upside down, so now in the life of the poor, many times the most pervasive criminal presence in their community will be the police, who tend to extract more money from the poor than perhaps anyone else in their community. So that's the fourth category of violence. Many times it's manifest most brutally by the phenomenon of pretrial detention, the capacity of the police to just throw poor people in prison. In fact, in any given year, there's about 10 million people held in pretrial detention without charge or trial, and overwhelmingly, they are the poorest citizens. Not only is it those 10 million, but then there are tens of millions of others who are dependent upon those who are being held in prison, and so it turns into an economic disaster that the breadwinner has been thrown in jail. By the way, if you are poor in the developing world and you are arrested and thrown in jail, and you can't afford an attorney, you don't get a bad attorney or a sleepy attorney or a drunk attorney. You get no representation at all. And overwhelmingly, you're likely to be in a proceeding in court in which you don't understand the language. The fourth category of violence against the poor is violent land theft. In fact, about 5 million poor people will be thrown off their land violently in a given year. And of course, the most vulnerable to this kind of abuse tend to be widows, especially in Africa. It's not just a sad thing to have your land stolen from you. Economists know that that usually is the greatest asset that gives a poor person a chance to get out of poverty or to even sustain their life, because that little plot of land is what gives them shelter and a little garden to produce some food. But when someone comes along and steals that land just because they are stronger, that widow is thrown into destitution. What also is true is that widows in the developing world, they support 500 million orphans. So not only is it the widows who are devastated by this, but then the children that they are supporting. So these are the four sort of vast categories of violence that are brought to the surface in our book, The Locust Effect. But then we begin to examine, well, what are the implications of this massive state of violence? And what, of course, we see is that this has a devastating impact on economic development of the poor, on their capacity to get out of poverty, and it horrifically undermines our poverty alleviation efforts in the developing world. One of the examples of this is girls' education. We now know that one of the most powerful ways to get people out of poverty is to get girls educated. It's called the girl effect. But just as we're beginning to appreciate this, studies are also demonstrating that one of the most powerful reasons girls are not attending school in the developing world is violence. Violence on the way to school, violence in the school, and violence in the home. So then the book begins to ask, well, why have criminal justice systems collapsed so badly in the developing world such that they are functionally non-operative for poor people? And we really look at four sort of surprising findings. The first is simply that these systems, as they now currently operate in the developing world, were never designed to protect the common poor person from violence. The criminal justice systems in the developing world were set up by colonial powers for the purpose of protecting the regime from the common person. And they've never been re-engineered now that the colonial powers have left. So you have a change of laws over the half century, but what you have not changed is the delivery system by which law enforcement is meant to be brought to the poor. So you'll go to the developing world and you'll find all these things that are absurd about the criminal justice system until you realize, oh, this wasn't even set up to enforce the law and fight crime for a common person. And the book explores this amazingly unaddressed legacy of colonial justice systems in the developing world. Secondly, and perhaps most powerfully, what the book exposes is the privatization of security which has taken place in the developing world. That is to say, everyone knows in these countries that you can't rely upon the police or the courts to protect you or your property. And so if you have money, you've purchased security with private security forces. In fact, in a city, in a country like Guatemala, private security forces are 7 times larger than the public police force. In India, it's the private security is 4 times larger than the public police force, even though that's the largest public police force in the world. In Africa, the largest employer in the entire continent is private security. So we now have a two-track system in the developing world where if you have enough money to pay for security, you can have a reasonable amount of safety. But if you can't afford to be safe, you're not. And what this is producing is now you can see in the aggregate, some of these countries are producing decent levels of economic growth, but that growth is coming in the sectors that have enough wealth to produce purchase private security. But if you're too poor to do that, you are not moving forward. The third reason for the collapse of these systems, that is the criminal justice systems, is they've been utterly neglected by our economic development and poverty alleviation efforts. The book looks at all the spending over the last half century on economic development, poverty alleviation in the developing world, and you can't find 1% of that of those resources going to addressing criminal justice systems so they'll effectively protect the poor from violence. And there's some interesting reasons why that is the case. The fourth and perhaps less surprising reason for the brokenness of these criminal justice systems is that there are people in power who would feel threatened if there were functioning criminal justice systems. And the book explores that reality. finally, the book makes the pivot towards hope. Because as you can imagine, you get this thus far through the book as we sort of have this afternoon, and you're probably all ready to take a nap, take some sort of medication for the depression. But the fact is, there's actually tremendous hope. And there's two sources of hope that we look at in the book. One is simply history. What you find is that every reasonably functioning criminal justice system in the world was at once brutal and corrupt. That is to say, every country actually engages a fascinating fight to not only set up a criminal justice system, but then to be able to get it back from either moneyed interests or political power that co-opts that system for its own purposes. And there is a struggle to make sure that that criminal justice system actually serves the common people. And what we find is a tremendous amount of hope from what has taken place in the past and some powerful lessons that can be learned, most fundamentally, that this is not impossible. Secondly, there's hope from some specific projects around the world that demonstrate it's possible to turn law enforcement in the developing world around. Particularly a project that we did in the International Justice Mission did in the Philippines, where with some support from the Gates Foundation, we targeted a city that had a horrific problem of child sex trafficking. And the goal of the project was to do two things. One, to try to improve the performance of the local law enforcement to see if they could switch sides. To switch sides from protecting the sex traffickers to actually protecting the children who are being abused. Would they actually be able to enforce the law effectively? And so after 4 years of this, we did find that they were able to radically transform their performance by setting up some specialized units, by setting up some fast-track courts, and tremendously improving the social services that are provided to the victims. The goal of the project was to produce a reduction in the victimization of children in the commercial sex trade by 20%, as measured by some outside auditors who drew a baseline first. How much child sex trafficking is there in this business? How much is there after IJM's project? And after 4 years, what the outside auditors were able to demonstrate was a 79% reduction in the victimization of children in the commercial sex trade, which simply demonstrated in a way that the people who oppress the poor are not brave. And if they begin to go to jail for these abuses, they will leave these children alone. Through the release of The Locust Effect, we're really urging readers to do two things. First of all, to just become educated and to help us change the conversation of poverty, to make sure that we're mainstreaming into the discussion of addressing global poverty the problem of violence. And one of the ways that we invite people to do that is to participate in pushing the conversation that's happening right now about the Millennium Development Goals at the UN to make sure that it includes a focus on violence. You may know that in the year 2000, the international community came up with this blueprint, definitive blueprint for addressing global poverty. And when this was written almost 15 years ago, there was a horrific omission, and that is there was zero mention of violence. And as those development goals are now being rewritten, we want to just make sure to embed that into the discussion. And so there actually is a place to go, thelocusteffect.com/petition, where we're gathering the signatures of just common citizens in a petition that's going to the UN General Secretary that says, in these Millennium Development Goals, let's make sure that we are including an attack on violence. In many respects, the epidemic of violence against the poor is much like the AIDS epidemic in the sense that it is rolling through the developing world in a way that's going to impact everything else that we are seeking to do. And so the first step is to begin to raise the alarm. And with the AIDS epidemic, it wasn't just the experts who told that story, but very common citizens who began to make sure that this was a priority concern for those who are in leadership. And likewise, we're hoping with the Locust Effect that people will educate themselves on this epidemic of violence and that they will begin to share this with their communities of influence and their circles of discussion so that as we move forward to try to address this dream of addressing global poverty, that addressing the problem of violence will become central to that work. thank you again for joining us on the launch of the book here in London, and so grateful to the Legatum Institute for hosting us today. So thank you very much.
Thank you. It's a very moving introduction to what is actually quite a searing and difficult book, but very, very well done. Would you like to respond, comment?
I'll comment a bit.
Okay.
But I mean, can you imagine how tough this is to come after that and try to do anything to make that even more clear? I think I probably got three points I wanted to say. The first is by way of a compliment, and it's to Gary and to IJM, because for a long time they've been looking at violence against women, they've been looking at land seizure, they've been looking at police corruption and all those forms of violence. But as practitioners on the ground, and so it's almost as if all of us start off saying, you know, here's this immediate person and this immediate problem, how do we work with them, how do we deal with it? I think there's a certain genius, or maybe it's a higher calling, or maybe it's a breadth of vision, when people begin to say, wait, we can stay here and keep working with individuals, but we have to think bigger than this. We have to bring our understanding up to global levels. And that's certainly the case with slavery, and it's certainly the case with all these forms of violence that IJM has been trying to bring justice to for a long time. But it's right that we stop thinking about this person and also thinking about the global, so that we become better equipped to help those individuals on the ground. The other is, you know, it's a long story, and I don't want to spend, I'm not going to talk a long time about a long story. It's just that, you know, particularly with slavery, and that's where I always have to go back to, is, you know, it's always been about violence. People today often say, oh, it's about supply chains, it's about an economic relationship. All of that could be true, but all of that is resting upon a foundation of violence. And it's a foundation of violence which has always been equally about the total control of one person through violent means, but especially an added level of violence to women. I have met no woman who has been enslaved who has not been sexually assaulted. And the idea that there's some sort of difference between a sex type of slavery and a different type of slavery, listen, for women it's not. You know, if you're a woman in slavery, you will be sexually assaulted. That's sort of the end of the story. That's the story of the United States when there was slavery there.
Right.
Sexual assault is part of that total control. And it leads to an interesting paradox, a horrific paradox, of the enslavement of women, because they are enslaved and brutalized on their exterior in the way men are, but also on their interior in a way that men are not. So it's paradoxical, because there's a totality to a slavery, but that totality is even more total for a woman than it is for a man. Mm-hmm. And that's something we still don't quite really have come to grips with, publicly or even within the movement itself. The last thing that I want to just throw out, because I really want to hear a lot more from Gary, and is this: how is it that we, in these rich countries where we have relatively high levels of peace and protection against violence, how is it we fail to comprehend this in a way that Gary is helping us and those in IJM are helping us to see this? And I want to throw out a couple of ideas about why I think we've been deluding ourselves. Because in our culture, and when I say ours, I mean both British culture, North American culture, highly educated cultures, which sort of set the tone around the world, not necessarily in Asian cultures. We employ and constantly repeat, but without naming them, two mythologies. The first mythology is the myth of pure evil. Now, I'm not saying that there is not horrible, bad people doing horrible, bad things to other people. But we tend to subscribe to and happily accept when politicians or leaders or sometimes spiritual leaders tell us that there are people who are pure evil, people who are in some ways different to us, like monsters. And for that reason, in the same way that you use the same logic to enslave someone, you're able to say, that person is not a real person. That person is not a full person. That person is a subhuman that I can take into under my control and turn them into slavery. When we do that and we assign violence as the primary attribute of this being of pure evil, it means that none of us can be that person. And then we address that mythology of this, of these beings of pure evil, and this mythology of who's either, you know, whether it's Saddam Hussein or the last person who was caught in a riot assaulting someone. We address that with what's called the myth of redemptive violence. We actually believe that violence can be used to redeem situations in which violence has been used. Now, I know that sounds odd to put it that way, but all you have to do is watch any kind of television. Almost any, every night, there's a replaying of the myth of redemptive violence. It's called a cop show. Mm. And there's a terrible crime of violence committed against usually a woman. They go through a whole period of investigation and confusion, and then they reach a moment right at the end when the person who is not a person of evil makes a tough decision, usually about not following the rules, but following their personal dictate, their personal sense of vengeance, and killing that person who committed the crime at the beginning, which provides the redemption that we all feel good about, and we all somehow assume that violence can be brought to violence as a way of ending violence. Mm. Now, we've got to break through that those notions of redemptive violence. Mm. Violence can never be redeeming. Mm. It can be destructive, and it can destroy those who have done bad things, but is that actually ultimately going to take us to the point where we can find in our souls, in our hearts, in our understanding, in our logic, in our cultures, a way to face up to the realities of violence, not the mythologies of violence.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Fantastic.
All right, thank you. Thank you. I'll start the discussion by asking, I wonder if I can get you to narrow what you said just for a minute, and return to this question of, because I was very intrigued by some of the things you said about local police forces.
Right.
Can you talk a little bit about what is, you know, what has worked, ways in which you can convince local police to start behaving like police should behave? And I'm asking you this because what we're talking about is a mentality change. It's not just an institutional change. You know, lots of times when people go into a country and they want to help people change something, they say, well, if you rewrite the rules in this way, then it will work out better. Or if you, you know, build this kind of courthouse, then you'll get this kind of result. But I think what you're talking about, that something that needs to happen, is really a mental change or an idea of what police should be. You know, that the police are there to protect the poor from being exploited or from being attacked. Can you talk a little bit about what kind of education, what kind of, have you had any experience with programs that make people think differently?
Sure. And it does go back to the basic organic training that the common police officer receives in the developing world, which is training in a system mostly of crowd control and personal security for elites. They are not basically trained to do criminal investigation, because that's not the colonial pattern or description of the job. And that has gone just unaddressed in terms of the fundamental orientation and training. So that just needs to be re-engineered. The job description needs to be changed, and the equipping for that job needs to change. You are going to tend to be also very defensive about what it is you don't do well and which you have no training to do well. And so one of the things that you find in the developing world is police forces are not transparent. They present themselves as these very gruff and brutal institutions, which in some ways they are. But an enormous amount of that is a defense mechanism to keep people from seeing how ill-trained, incompetent, and ill-resourced they are. So that basic definition of what their job needs to change, and also then the equipping of them. What also is true is that what has happened is that the basic orientation has been one because they are fundamentally treated so badly themselves, that is, ill provided for, ill paid, dishonored by the community, that they fundamentally have been given license then to just use their position to extort money from the populace. We were talking about the Georgian police system which went through an extraordinary transformation in the year 2003, which in 2003, Georgia was ranked as more corrupt than any country that IJM was working in at the time. And the way the policing worked there is that you paid a $10,000 bribe in order to become a police officer for a job that paid you $10 a month. Because you knew when you were appointed a police officer that then you had this power to extract money from people. And then the people who are receiving the bribes in the senior police force get it figured out, well, we should have lots of police then if everybody gives us a $10,000 bribe. So these bloated police forces that are ill-paid, ill-trained, and never actually have the function of protecting the common person from crime. So we have found, though, that one of the ways that you demonstrate this is what's possible is by setting up a specialized vetted unit. That is to say, you don't have to clean up the entire police force all at once, but set up a specialized unit that is not corrupt, that has accountability, and is very well trained, and demonstrate it has success. And then you can also, because a police force is a command structure, you can actually clean it up quite quickly if there's political will at the top of the chain of command. And we also refer in the book to this 15-70-15 rule that's not very scientific, but it's our basic experience, which is in a police force, 15% wake up every day trying to hurt people and use their authority to extort as much as they can. 15% show up, God bless them, trying to do the right thing regardless of the odds. And the 70% in the middle just are waiting to see which 15% is going to prevail. Mm-hmm. And if the corrupt and brutal ones are winning, then they are cooperating with that endeavor. But if the corrupt and brutal ones are getting fired and losing their jobs and going to jail, boy, that 70% in the middle, they scoot right quickly on over to join those who are prevailing by doing the right thing. So much of this can change much quicker than we might imagine.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting. I have the same experience when writing about authoritarian regimes.
Yeah.
That there's this 10% who, you know, sort of bad guys who collaborate, and there's 10% who are really freedom fighters.
Yeah.
And then everybody else is trying to get through the day and
exactly.
feed their families, and
they
just, you know, make their lives work.
And it goes to your point that you can look at a police force in the developing world and say, oh, they're all evil and horrible, but actually they are having horrific leadership, they're not given decent incentives, and if treated well, they can actually start to do the right thing.
My father, after 33 years as a special agent in the FBI,
yeah.
went into police training.
Yeah.
And he began to train police officers in tiny little rural towns in Oklahoma and Texas where they had no training. They were just usually the football star who'd been hired on
right.
as a local,
right.
you know, because they weren't smart enough to go to university. And I remember sitting with him once and saying, so what's the most important thing you work with these guys? It's criminal investigation, firearms safety,
yeah.
you know,
yeah.
what do you do? He said, well, you know, I do all that stuff, but I really only have one lesson.
I think we will end, and I hope we'll continue the conversation informally. So thank you very much.
Thank you.